This is the Yara Crop Nutrition Podcast. Yara is the global leader in crop nutrition knowledge and the leading producer of quality fertilizer products. The podcast is intended to facilitate the transfer of knowledge for farmers and crop advisors, improving farm profitability and environmental sustainability. With Yara, knowledge grows.
Hey, thanks for joining another edition of the Yara Crop Nutrition Podcast. We are here with Dr. Steve Petrie for another agronomic tip of the week. We release these every Tuesday morning. And today's podcast is on soil pH. And we're going to talk about why that's important, why you need to know what your soil pH is and how that can affect your nutrition. But I have one quick question for you. This is, I guess you could maybe say this is a try to stump Dr. Steve question. When you write pH, why is the P small and the H big?
I happen to know the answer to that, Scott.
Okay.
It goes back to when the pH scale was first developed. Mm-hmm. And the idea, you know, it before that, or what the pH scale is actually defined as, the word pH, or that refers to the activity, which is usually approximated by the concentration mm-hmm. of the hydrogen ion in solution. And so technically it's the activity. We would use concentration as a very close approximation. And so it turns out that water at pH 7, which is neutral, has 0.000001 moles of hydrogen ions per liter of water.
Okay.
And a pH 6 is 0.00. You can go through the math on that. It's 5 zeros and 1 moles per liter. Well, it's very cumbersome and awkward to write point and then a bunch of zeros and 1 or 2 or 3, whatever the deal is. So then they said, well, you know, we can write it in scientific notation where it's 1 × 10⁻⁷. Remember back to high school and tables of logarithms and so forth. Well, the concept was that the P, I think this is from the German, because of course Germans were famous scientists back in the day, and the word power in the German translation escapes me, but it was power of the hydrogen ion concentration. And so the hydrogen ion concentration was -1 × 10⁻⁷. You take the -7, and then you put the negative in, it makes it a negative negative, becomes a positive mm-hmm. 7.
I see.
And so the hydrogen ion, I made a mistake in the very beginning. It's the minus log of the hydrogen ion activity or hydrogen ion concentration. And since the log of -7 is -7, the negative log of that minus, you know, a negative becomes a positive, so it was 7. So it was easier to write 7 than it was 0.000001. and that's what it comes from, is the chemists who developed that notation system back right around 1900, if I believe.
Oh, interesting. I don't think I ever knew that. That's we could stop the podcast now. We've educated the world. Thank you, Steve.
There you go. There you go.
Why is pH important? Why do we need to know the acidity level of the soil?
Well, and something that you just stated right there, I want to come back to a little bit. We talk about the pH of the soil because that's how we measure the acidity in the soil. And what really is a concern to us is the acidity of the soil or the alkalinity of the soil. And in soils that are extremely acid or extremely alkaline, can have adverse effects on a whole bunch of factors. So physical properties, chemical properties, biological properties, all of which can affect, usually negatively, our crop growth. And so we're concerned about the soil acidity in most situations. Less frequently, we're concerned about excessive alkalinity or the soil pH is too high. So there's a number of reasons. I mentioned, you know, there's biological, chemical, and physical. If we look at the biological, the adverse effects on the biology of the soil, particularly acidic soils, are much less conducive to microbial activity. In fact, pH is less than about 4.5. Microbial activity is greatly slowed. And of course, microbial activity affects the breakdown of plant residues. Nutrient cycling is greatly slowed. Release of organic matter, the nitrogen in the organic matter is greatly slowed below pH 4.5. And even some of the fertilizer reactions, the conversion of ammonium from ammonium fertilizers to nitrate is greatly reduced at pH less than 4.5 or 5. And so when we get into situations where the soils are extremely acidic, we can end up with adverse effects on availability of nitrogen because we're not releasing it from organic matter. We're not converting it from ammonium over to nitrate. And again, as we've talked previously, most plants prefer most of their nitrogen in the nitrate form. So that's the biology. Chemistry effects are also very striking. And as we get into extremely acid soils, we get greatly reduced availability of some of the critical macronutrients like phosphorus. And we can actually build up toxic levels of some of the constituents in the soils. The most common ones are aluminum. And then less commonly, we can see toxicities of manganese and even iron. But aluminum toxicity is the most common. And as we get below pH about 5.1 or 5.2, we see striking increases in the possibility of aluminum toxicity at that acid soil pH range. And then, of course, chemical effects, or we mentioned physical properties and physical effects. On the other end of that scale, when we're in extremely high pH soils, that in many cases is indicative of both salinity, but real badly, sodicity. Excessive sodium in a soil, which occurs in some situations, the pH of the soil is typically above 8.3. In those situations, we have adverse effects on the soil physical properties because of the high concentration of sodium. And so depending on the pH, we can look at adverse effects on the biology, the chemistry, and the physical properties of soils.
So it sounds like a pH of 7, which is neutral, is ideal. If we go back to the question I asked you about soil texture and structure, I put out there Steve Petrie's Farming LLC is going off to buy a piece of land. What is the ideal soil characteristics that you want? I'll ask the same question. If you were to go out and you wanted to have the perfect pH for your field, what would that be? What would you like to see? What range would you like to be
in? Sure. For most crops, somewhat near normal, as you mentioned, would be considered ideal. Mm-hmm. 6.5 to 7, maybe 7.5 is the generally thought to be the ideal pH for most crops. Mm-hmm. Now, there are some notable exceptions to that. And blueberries are one of them, for example. Blueberries are typically thought to require a very acidic environment. Uptake of micronutrients by blueberries are greater, and iron in particular is one that's more available on extremely acid pHs, and blueberries are adapted to do well in a high iron environment. It turns out we can manipulate the fertilizer rates, the sources and placement and so forth to grow blueberries even on relatively high pH soils, but it takes more management. Again, there's a few other exceptions, but very typically we would look at near neutral pHs as the optimum combination of nutrient availability and then the good effects on the biology, chemistry, and physical properties of that soil. So around neutral.
Okay. How do soils become either alkaline or acidic? Are they naturally in this neutral state and they develop this way because of our management practices, or how do they become, go to each extreme?
Sure. Well, typically we would think of alkaline soil pHs in low rainfall environments and lower rainfall, 15, less than 20 inches a year, for example. And there's all sorts of gray around that value because of the parent material from the soil that the soil was formed from and so forth. But typically lower rainfall soils have a higher pH because the basic cations, calcium, magnesium, potassium, have not been leached out of the soil in those lower rainfall areas. we get into the higher rainfall areas, you know, the Midwestern Corn Belt or 30 or 40 inches of rain there, 50 or 60 in the southeastern United States and some other places, there's been sufficient rainfall to leach the basic cations out of the soil. And so the pHs tend to be acidic in those environments. And so natural occurring pHs in low rainfall areas tend to be alkaline, high rainfall areas tend to be acidic. Mm-hmm. So that's the kind of the natural backdrop. Now, much of what we do to the soil, or some of what we do to the soil at least, can have an effect on soil pH as well. And the number one factor that we do is the use of ammonium-based fertilizers, NH4 fertilizers, ammonium sulfate, ammonium nitrate, if you can still get it, urea, anhydrous ammonia, aqua ammonia, 32 solution. All of those have a substantial portion, or maybe all of their nitrogen, as ammonium, NH4. And the oxidation or the biological conversion of ammonium over to nitrate releases hydrogen ions. And those hydrogen ions are very simply the cause of soil acidity. So higher rates of ammonic or ammonium-based fertilizers for a longer period of time contributes to greater soil acidity. And in fact, there's been some long-term studies at various places around the United States, and there is a very good correlation between the pH depression over time and the total amount of ammonium that has been applied to those soils. So that's the first factor, use of ammonium fertilizers. Second is use of elemental sulfur as a sulfur fertilizer. Now, we need to be very careful here because elemental sulfur, when it's oxidized by the bacteria in the soil, results in, we can think about it essentially as the formation of sulfuric acid. It's a little more complex than that, but we form hydrogen ions and sulfate ions in the soil, the microbial population that's oxidizing the sulfur, the thiobacillus organisms, cause the elemental sulfur to convert to sulfate, and there's hydrogen ions released in that process. And so use of elemental sulfur will also contribute to soil acidity. Now, I keep stressing elemental sulfur because sulfate sulfur, SO4, does not lower soil pH. And the use of gypsum, for example, which is calcium sulfate, gypsum is considered a neutral salt. It doesn't raise the pH because of the calcium, and it doesn't lower the pH because of the sulfate. Neither one of those ions, the calcium cation or the sulfate anion, has any effect on soil pH. And so gypsum is a neutral salt. Even though it contains sulfur, it's in the sulfate form. And so that doesn't have any effect on pH. It's only the elemental sulfur that will lead to the lowering of soil pH or increase in acidity.
So, Steve, we've identified that the optimal pH for your soil should be around 6.5 to 7, 7.5, so that you're optimizing your nutrition plan or the fertilizers that you're applying. If we have high pH, what can we do to bring that pH lower or make a fertilizer work in a higher pH situation?
Sure. Well, two different answers here, depending on how high is high.
Okay.
And if the pH is above 8.3, typically those soils are affected by sodium, and the exchangeable sodium percentage will be greater than about 15%. There is probably some adverse effects on the physical properties in the soil. The structure's been degraded. There's surface crusting and sealing, and the water infiltration's very slow. So if we can leach the sodium out of that soil by applying more irrigation water than the crop needs and putting on leaching fractions and, you know, more, and that's a whole nother subject, but we can put on additional water and leach the sodium out, then that soil pH will decline. And the soil pH will go down to maybe 8.2 to 8.3. Now, that anything above 8.3 is a red flag that there's probably excess sodium in that system. To get the pH above 8.3 generally requires excess sodium. So first, leaching could take the pH from 8.7 down to about 8.3, for example. But to get it from lower than that, requires the application of acid, because we want to neutralize the alkalinity with acid. And very quickly, it's generally impractical, uneconomical, and not routinely done to effectively lower the pH from 8.3 down to 7. It's the amount of alkalinity in a soil, if there's any free lime at all, even 1% free lime, which is a very low level of free lime in some of our Western soils, even that would require large amounts of acid, impractical and not commonly done. But what can be done if the soil pH is high enough that it's reducing availability of critical micronutrients like iron, zinc, manganese, and copper, phosphorus availability is reduced on those high pH soils, we can band an acid-forming fertilizer either through liquid application or dry application in a band, or we can use acid-forming fertilizers in a drip irrigation system, which will concentrate the acidity from those materials into a small enough zone where we can lower the pH and increase the availability of those normally unavailable nutrients. Again, zinc, iron, manganese, and copper, and micronutrients. Phosphorus is the major nutrient that we would worry about being less available on alkaline or high pH soils. Probably can't change the bulk pH, but we can change it in a small zone and markedly increase the availability of those nutrients sufficient to take care of the plant needs. So that's the first thing on a high pH soil to lower it. Probably not practical, but we can manage our fertilizer placement and sources to increase the availability and if not solve the soil problem, at least increase the nutrient availability to our crops.
What about on the other side of the coin? What if we have very acidic soils? How can we, is there a way that we can raise that?
Yes, and it turns out that that's much more practical. In fact, very commonly done in areas with higher rainfall where soils are more acidic. There's generally liming is part of the routine management of those fields. The timing is going to depend on the desired pH, the buffer capacity of the soil, and other factors. But maybe a 5 to 10 year plan would be to apply lime in those soils to offset the acidity from the ammonium fertilizers and the leaching of cations that occurs in the high rainfall environment and so forth. There are specific soil tests that are run by laboratories which can predict with a pretty good accuracy how much lime needs to be applied to increase the soil pH from whatever it is to whatever is the desired level. And I want to make sure I clear up something that I may have misspoke earlier. Mm-hmm. I said the pH of 6.5 to 7 is optimum. Mm-hmm. There is a lot of crop variability around that. On one hand, we look at something like legumes, and alfalfa is, of course, the queen of the forage crops. We like soil pH for alfalfa to be up pretty close to neutral. 6.8 is usually the desired pH. For some other crops, corn and some other grasses, we can tolerate as low as 6.5 or maybe even 6. And wheat can tolerate down 5.5 before we see adverse effects on yield in most situations. Now, the problem is that if we're on a downward decline of soil pH because of ammonium fertilizers and so forth, if the pH is going down 1 or 2 units a year, which is not unheard of, if you wait till you're right at the threshold of the soil being too acidic, then you need to put on lime. It takes a while for that lime to react, and there's a likelihood that there's going to be some adverse effect on crop growth. So even though some of our crops are more acid tolerant, I still don't like to see the soil pH bumping up against that critical level. I like to see the farmers managing their pH earlier proactively and not letting it get that close to the acid range where it's a problem.
Once again, better to prevent than to correct, right?
Exactly. Yep. Now, that doesn't mean that, I mean, you still need to put on lime. That's the most practical way. But instead of waiting till the last possible year, do it a couple years ahead of time. Mm-hmm. Spend the money now, spend the money later. You're better off to spend it now. The other consideration that needs to come into play here is I've been focusing on ammonium-based fertilizers because of the conversion of ammonium to nitrate releasing hydrogen ions. If we skip that step, and if we apply nitrate-based fertilizers, those fertilizers have much less or no effect on soil pH. Mm. And so if we look at products like the calcium nitrate family of products from Yara, some of those products are almost pure nitrate, like CN9 or Tropicote or Calcinate. Those are about 94% of the nitrogen is nitrate. Those theoretically actually have a slight liming value. Now, if we look at other materials like CAN17, UCAN17, UCAN23, those have some ammonium present. In some cases, in the UCAN17 and UCAN23, they have some urea as well. And those do contribute to soil acidity, but much less than the fertilizers that are predominantly ammonium. And so one way to proactively manage the effect of the nitrogen fertility program on the soil pH is to consider those fertilizers that are nitrate-based or predominantly nitrate. And the cost of those fertilizers is in some cases offset, at least partially, by the reduced lime that needs to be applied because they're less acid forming. Looking at the total cost of those fertilizers, they may be much more competitive than simply the cost out front. You have to pay for that nitrogen that's applied as ammonium later.
What's the easiest way, most effective way to find out what the acidity level or the pH level in our soil is? Is there some hands-on process, or are we back to getting that soil sample done?
Well, there is a wide range of accuracy and cost for determining soil pH. You can use a simple colorimetric paper, the litmus paper. You get the soil moist with a certain amount of water to soil. You put the litmus paper in the water, let the reaction occur, and then you compare the color of that test paper to a scale, and it tells you whether the pH was 6 or 7 or 8 or whatever. Some of the more accurate papers can get you within maybe a quarter of a pH unit reasonably well. They're not awful. Many of them are very qualitative, though. They're not very accurate. They're more like, well, your soil's probably acid. We probably knew that ahead of time, and they're not very reliable. They're just very basic indicators. I would not use those for any kind of an economic decision about fertilizers or liming or anything, but just to see what's going on out in the yard, you might be okay. The next step are some of the portable pH meters, and these are available for, in round figures, $100 on Amazon or other sources. And again, you mix that with a certain amount of soil and water, and you can actually do fairly well with those. They're not great, but they're an indicator at least, and you can use them in the field. They do require some care. They need to be taken care of and monitored, you know, not just thrown in the dash and left out in the sun. They need to be cared for a little bit. They need to be calibrated every so often against known standards and so forth. They're not bad. I've used those out in the field as for teaching and for demonstration purposes. But that's a $100 instrument. The laboratories will use an instrument that I think the least expensive one we ever bought at the research center I used to run was about $1,500. They go up after that. And the more, it's just like anything else, you get what you pay for. Mm-hmm. And the more that you spend, the more accurate they are, the more durable they are. But they still require care and calibration and so forth. But so the laboratory that you send a lab sample to or a soil sample to, they're using a very expensive instrument and getting you a very good number. The thing that you do in the field with the $100 portable probe may be accurate enough depending on the intended use. If you're going to base a lime program on the soil pH, then you have to send it to a laboratory because that's a different test than simply measuring the pH. It has to measure not only the pH, but what essentially is the buffer capacity of that soil, because there's what we used to call active acidity and reserve acidity. The active acidity of two soils could be the same, and one soil might have much more reserve acidity or a much higher buffer capacity, and therefore require more lime, even though the initial pH would be the same. An example might be, we were talking about soil texture in one of our previous podcasts. The difference between a sandy soil like a sandy loam or a loamy sand would have very low cation exchange capacity, and one could adjust the lime or adjust the pH with relatively little lime compared to a clay loam, for example, or a silt loam that would have a much higher cation exchange capacity. and at the same pH would require much more lime than the loamy sand. Hmm. Even though the pHs might be the same, the buffer capacity of the soils would be very different. Much more lime would be required. And with the proper soil test, that's very accurate to predict how much more lime would need to be applied.
Is the pH test that a lab does, is that typically included in a basic soil analysis?
Yes, typically in an environment like out west here, they just run the standard pH because mm-hmm. in most situations you're not worried about possibility of liming. In some environments where it's more common, they'll run both a standard soil pH and then they'll make reference to a buffer pH or to other, they'll have other words, and the labs vary on that. That second value will be different. The buffer pH will be different than the standard soil pH because it's also accounting for that reserve pH or the buffer potential. And so it'll give you a different value, and you have to compare those to charts to see how much lime to apply. But some labs will just routinely run both of them.
And as you mentioned early, it's probably good to track the soil pH over time. Yep. So if we haven't convinced you already, normal, regular, disciplined soil analysis is critical for you not only to understand what's happening on a nutrient level, but also on a pH level. If you see a downward trend on the pHs, get ahead of the curve, treat it before it becomes a problem, and then you have to really invest a lot of money to try to bring that soil back into a good neutral state.
Exactly. Ideally, I'd like to see samples taken every year at the same time of year from the same locations within the field so that you can really develop a history. Now, if people are renting ground and moving around, well, that's obviously less able to do that. But if you're running your own ground and managing it, take a spring sample or a fall sample, be consistent over time because some values will be different spring to fall. But if you're consistent, then you can track those over time and see, I started out with a pH of 6.5, which was fine. And over the last 20 years, that's fallen down to 5.5 or 5.3 or whatever. And all of a sudden I'm looking at a situation where I definitely am going to need to put lime into my future, and the future might be next year. If you can start tracking that, keep it over time, you say, okay, we're getting down there. Let's build our budget around it. It is essentially a capital purchase because lime lasts for many, many years in the soil. So it's not like an annual purchase. Mm-hmm. It's one for 10 years. And so you can budget for that and know that, okay, I'm going to have to spend a certain amount of money in a few years. Build that into your long-term budgeting.
So, Steve, I want to come back to taking these soil samples the same time of year. Is it true that a pH can change over the season? So if you're taking a test in the spring and taking a test in the fall, that may not be a good correlation. You want to take it the same time every year.
Yes, the soil pH values can be as much as a half a unit difference between spring and fall. Mm-hmm. And the other thing that can matter is some laboratories will measure the soil pH with one part of soil and two parts of water, mm-hmm. a 2-to-1 water to soil. Some will use 1-to-1. Some will use a saturated paste where the soil is wetted until the surface is just slick and the pH meter is inserted into that. Other is the pH meter is inserted into the liquid above the soil and so forth. So those have different, the same soil will give different pH values depending on how much water is added. They're all good values. They can all be interpreted, but you can't compare a saturated paste to a 2-water-1 soil extracted, and they're going to give you different values. And so make sure that you're comparing apples to apples. If you have different laboratories, you might get different values simply because they're doing a different soil to water extract.
That's a good thing to know. When you're talking about adding water to the soil before you do this test, I would assume you need to be careful on what type of water you're adding, right? What kind of water do we use?
You'd want to use distilled water.
Distilled water, okay.
Standard. You could use that, deionized would be, but to just simply get distilled water from the store that you can buy it for $1.25 a gallon. People use it in their irons and so forth, and for where you don't want minerals, that'd be a good source. It's going to be neutral.
Great. Well, I think it's been a very good discussion on soil pH. Thank you very much. I think it helps us understand what is pH, where should the optimal range be, and if we're on the extreme of one side or the other, how we can address that, and more importantly, that we should track it and find out where that pH trend is going and address issues early. So thank you very much, Steve. And we'll talk to you again next Tuesday. Don't forget to subscribe. Don't forget to share it with your friends. And we hope that this increased your knowledge.
Talk to you next week, Scott.
You've been listening to the Yara Crop Nutrition Podcast. For more information about our company, please visit us at www.yara.com or yara.us, or for Canada, yaracanada.ca.